Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we bring you different stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Imagine for a moment that you're a recent college graduate, and you get an email from a company saying one of your professors has recommended you for a job. After an interview, done remotely, you get an offer. You even get a check to cover some preliminary expenses, like buying your work laptop. But the offer wasn't real. It was a scam, and not only are you now out the money, the scammers have your bank account information. Wall Street Journal reporter Ray Smith covers career and workplace issues, and he recently wrote about this new scam preying upon college graduates. Welcome to All Sides, Ray.
Thank you.
Can you walk me through this scam? So how does it work? It starts with this reach out, hey, your professor has recommended you for a job.
Yes, that's one way that it starts. It's someone that the student might be familiar with. It could be a faculty advisor or some other sort of school staff member. And they claim to have some familiarity with the campus or the student. And they'll say something like, you applied for this job or we have this offer. Would you be interested? And so that's usually how it starts. And the student sort of suspects that it's actually from the professor, or even if they don't know the professor personally, they're kind of flattered, you know, so they don't have any reason to think that a professor wouldn't be recommending them.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, the old adage, it's not what you know, it's who you know. And yeah, if you were in a professor's class and you know you got a good grade, you might be like, oh, okay, maybe he was talking about me with this recruiter and like now this guy is reaching out.
Exactly. And so what happens next is usually they'll start to try to get the student engaged and sending information, and they'll probably ask the student at some point to go download some other platform, like a messaging platform, maybe like WhatsApp or Signal or something like that. I even learned of one called Session earlier. And they'll try to get them to start like doing an online interview or almost in chat form, almost like not even seeing an actual person. So they'll try to engage the person through texting on this platform that they are asked to download.
And these are usually offers for remote working positions, which, I mean, post-pandemic does not sound weird. And in a lot of cases, like people are, you know, increasingly they want work from home gigs. So essentially they go through this interview process, they're offered a remote position, and then they're sent a check.
Yes, that's right. And I'm so glad you brought this up, because the work from home since COVID era is a big reason why these scams are proliferating, because they know that a lot of people would prefer to work from home. So that makes them easy prey. And so in this case, what they'll say is, okay, we've got this remote opportunity, and what we're going to do is send you some, you know, work from home equipment. It can be a laptop, even, you know, office furniture or some software that they might need. And they'll say, we will send you this. And they'll start to sort of get into this weird zone where they'll say, we're going to send you money to purchase this. Can you, you know, provide us with your banking information, or can we, you know, can we mail the check to you? And then you will deposit that check. That's the goal, to get you to deposit that check into your own account.
Yeah, it's sort of like the process of onboarding. And, you know, as a job seeker, you might not think it's so weird for them to take your bank account information, because they're going to need it to send you paychecks.
Exactly. That's the other wrinkle. And plus, you know, imagine your excitement. You're like, oh, it's a remote opportunity, and I don't have to buy my own laptop. They're, you know, look at this. They're forwarding me the money to do it. And so, you know, so students can really get caught up in this, especially if you are thinking, like you just said, of course they're going to need my banking information, because they're going to, you know, I'm going to get paid. They're going to send me, you know, direct deposit.
Yeah, even a stipend to buy office, a home office and a laptop, that doesn't, like post-COVID, getting a specific amount of money to get an office set up, that doesn't sound weird. That sounds like something a company might really offer.
Exactly. And that's one of the tricky things about this and scary things about this, because it does sound legitimate. I mean, people they lead people on to this far to actually say yes and deposit a check. So
I want you to, can you share what happened in Cody's case? He was a senior at George Mason University in Virginia. And what happened in his situation?
So he was unfortunately a victim of this type of scam where he was reached out to with an internship for a data analyst position. And what they basically told him was, we will send you this money so that you can purchase this work from home equipment. And they sent him a check and he deposited it. And shortly after that, he was told that he needed to either Zelle or Apple Pay the money to a vendor, the vendor of this supposed equipment,
Oh no.
for this to go through. And so he went ahead, even though he had some questions about like why are they asking me to do that, but he was told to do it. And he told me that he was told like it's imminent that you do this now. So you see where this is going. Like they made it like
That
you
sounds
have
like
to
the
Zelle.
hallmark of a scam, right? The immediacy, the urgency, so you don't think it through.
Right, exactly. And he's excited. He's like, yeah, I want to start this job as soon as I can, this internship. And so he did go through with the Zelle, or I can't remember if he used Zelle or Apple Pay to be honest, but he did go through with an electronic transfer. And what ended up happening was the check that he deposited into his account bounced, and he was out 17 seven I'm sorry $1,745. So it's just really unfortunate that this happened to him, and he kind of suspected something was off. He did end up notifying his bank and the FBI and the police, but it was way too late. He had got suckered in.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And I mean, I use Zelle. I use all those kinds of cash apps. They're so common now. Like you all go out to dinner and everybody Venmos the person that puts it on their card. So they are sort of preying on these like cultural norms that it's not weird to do certain things like that. It's not weird to have a remote job. It's not weird to probably just have a phone interview or like even a non-phone interview. Also the job market is kind of challenging right now. For all we talk about a tight labor market, it's only a tight labor market for like certain kinds of positions. You spoke with a guy, a grad named Jorge Robles, and he said he applied to more than 300 jobs after graduating.
And he's still looking. You're absolutely right. It's a tough market out there for certain roles and certain professions. And he was one of those people who was very excited when finally someone got back to him. It turned out to be a scam, but that's the point, that he was so excited that he didn't, his guard was sort of let down because he was so eager to hear from someone that I guess, the usual sort of questions he might have asked, he suspended disbelief. And so he went down this rabbit hole with this company, even though he had some questions. Like for instance, the email address was sort of off and it looked like an entirely new domain. But as he told me, I still gave it a chance because, I was just so eager to hear from someone. And it turns out as he did more investigation, they asked him to do some kind of interview, and answer some questions online. Again, not dealing with any person face to face or that he can see. He was told, he got the job even though he really didn't, actually interview, formally, and that was a red flag to him. He just, called the company to sort of confirm that this offer was real and this was happening, and they told him not only that it was a hoax, but that it was like maybe the third or fourth time that they had heard from people about this. So he wasn't even the only one.
Job scammers are also using job boards and networking sites like ZipRecruiter, Indeed, LinkedIn. What kind of scams are they running here? Like they reach out to you via LinkedIn and say like, "Hey, we think you'd be a candidate for this job."
I have to tell you, As I was reporting this story, and I was on these sites like LinkedIn and ZipRecruiter, I don't know if it's the algorithms or what, but I started getting text messages about job offers and message emails about job offers
Oh
from,
my goodness.
fake recruiters. Yeah, it was really, it's just like, it's scary how, your own searching for whatever on the internet can sort of prompt, alert people that you're looking for something. And yeah, I was surprised as I was reporting this. So, but to answer your question directly, on LinkedIn, especially, it seems to be a problem. A lot of people that I've talked to have talked about getting these messages in LinkedIn, or getting, or the scammers find people's profiles on LinkedIn, and a lot of people have their resume and their phone number.
Oh,
Yeah, and so right, and so these scammers will look all that information up, and so they'll text people on their personal phones. They'll claim that, I saw you on LinkedIn, or I saw your resume on LinkedIn or ZipRecruiter, and they'll try that way to engage with a person to try to scam them.
and we've been talking a lot about college graduates, but this sounds like the kind of scam that could ensnare really anyone looking for a job these days.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we focus on college students and graduates because we were talking to some watchdog agencies, and they were especially concerned about young people because they are so comfortable sharing so much online. And I talked to one woman who was like, yeah, I signed up to all these websites and I don't even read the terms of agreement, so who knows who has my email? And sure enough, someone got her email and was emailing her about a fake job. And they're also, they're new to the relatively new to the job market, so they don't have the sophistication to easily spot something's, wrong here. But before we went down the college student rabbit hole, I did talk to some older folks who also were recipients of these kinds of scam emails, including a woman who is like semi-retired, and she's like 64. And I had a long interview with her, and she was like, I'm out here looking for something remote. And somehow they knew that. And so yeah, it can really happen across ages. And but young people are especially vulnerable.
So, what are some real red flags that this job offer might be fake?
It used to be much easier to tell, because, like, for instance, there were obvious misspellings, or they wouldn't address you by your real name, or your first name, or they would sort of have emails that you can just tell were wrong, that were just incorrect or fake. They've gotten a lot more sophisticated, and so really, one thing that people should do, here is a case where Google is really your best friend. Just type in, if you're suspicious at all, just type in the name of whatever email or company's contacting you, and then type scam. A lot of times people on Reddit especially are posting about, did you get the scam message, or I got the scam message, and alerting others. So that can immediately tell you, if something is wrong. But also just check, email domains and how recently they've been formed. You should also be nervous about when you receive a text, especially if it's on your personal phone or through WhatsApp. You should really confirm with the company, or just even look on their website, because now a lot of these companies and even recruiting firms will say on their websites, we do not contact you on your personal phone, or we don't text you job offers, or we don't, they'll say what they don't do, so you can know, oh, a company wouldn't reach out to me that way, or a company wouldn't do this, or a company wouldn't ask me, to pay money, or to deposit money, or to get, or to Venmo, or to Zelle. So there are ways you can sort of, if you're feeling strange about something, you can even check these companies' websites to see how they they formally do these hiring processes and interviews.
Or you could shoot off, if it is a legit company, like a real one that exists, you can always shoot off an email or call their HR too and be like, hey, I'm not sure if this is real and I just want to double check with you.
Exactly. And a couple of people I talked to did exactly that. Exactly. And you can also, I mean, especially in the case of, younger people or college students, go over it with parents or, older relative or a mentor. Just have them, go over it with you.
And then I think, I mean, phone interviews, Zoom interviews, those are commonplace now, but it sounds like a chat interview, that sounds like it should be a red flag that they don't want to talk to you either over the phone or over Zoom.
Yeah, that should really raise eyebrows and concerns, because you really don't know who you're talking to, and if someone seems reluctant to give you a phone number or show themselves or identify themselves, that's a clear sign that something fishy is going on. Even in this age where there, like you said, there is the Zoom interview and there are different ways of interviewing, and there may even be some inputting of information before the actual interview, you still should really be wary of anything that's just all chat, especially if you're asking, well, how can we do this on Zoom with your cameras on, or is there a number I can reach you at, or something? Or I should have brought this up earlier too. There should be names attached with some of these messages, and this is tricky. You can look them up on LinkedIn or just what their profiles are online. And why I say this is tricky because sometimes these people even create fake LinkedIn profiles, so you just have to be extra vigilant.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Ray Smith. Thanks for all your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, how college students are helping solve the IT shortage. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I'm your host, Anna Staver. So, how do small businesses with small budgets protect themselves from cyber attacks? What about small nonprofits? Are they sitting ducks for politically motivated attacks? Colleges across the country may have the solution: students. More than 15 universities now offer cybersecurity clinics where their students get hands-on work. They're part of a growing consortium of cyber community clinics, cybersecurity clinics, powered by college students and professors. And Professor Scott Shackelford is the executive director of applied cybersecurity research at Indiana University. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
We also have Sydney Schnurr, I hope I said that right, who just graduated from law school at Indiana University in Bloomington, and she participated in the consortium this school year. Welcome to All Sides, Sydney.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, I'll start with you. How did Indiana University get into the cybersecurity business?
Well, we have been in that business for quite some time now, for more than 25 years. And like many organizations, unfortunately, it was, partly in response to a data breach, right? That was our wake-up call. And since then, there was a big push to build out the operational side of the house, to make sure this doesn't happen again, and also to dovetail that with a lot of educational offerings to help train the next generation of cybersecurity professionals and to make sure that that training was done in an interdisciplinary way. So we don't just have, for example, lawyers talking to lawyers and engineers talking to engineers about this problem. Instead, we hope to break down barriers and build some bridges and hopefully help out communities in the process.
So essentially, you have businesses come in and they work with students and with you as like an advisor to solve their cybersecurity issues. Is that how this works?
Pretty much, yeah. So we founded the Cybersecurity Clinic here at IU about 5 years ago now, and it came out of a series of just one-off engagements we had with state agencies, local governments, communities, some of which were really small, but occasionally had to host massive events like Speedway Indiana. And we just saw there was a huge demand there. So we decided to try to formalize the structure and start helping clients at scale. So we started doing that in 2020 in earnest with some funding from the Hewlett Foundation. And that allowed us to now start to help four, five, six clients a term and to expand the number of degree programs and students that we're engaging with so that we have, for example, law students alongside business students and cyber risk management students working together to help address a community's needs, like responding to a ransomware attack or coming up even just with a game plan for who's supposed to do what in the aftermath of a data breach.
So, Sydney, you just graduated law school, so congratulations. Good luck with the bar. But
thank you.
What drew you to want to be part of this consortium?
Yeah, so actually, I started law school with a strong interest in intellectual property law, and I have a science background in biology. But I've always been interested in cybersecurity, and I took privacy law with Professor Tomain. And he talked about the cybersecurity clinic a decent amount in the class. And I thought that that would be a great way for me to learn and get some hands-on experience with cybersecurity.
So what kind of projects did you work on? I don't know how much you're like allowed to talk about, but like what kind of projects did you work on and as much as you can say?
Yeah, so my main project was working with a professor from the business school, Dr. Dayton, and he helps with this IU initiative called the Center for Rural Engagement. So what me and my team did for two semesters was we helped teach rural communities and also small businesses about cybersecurity. And then we also worked on making PowerPoints and a website and videos that would be educational for small rural communities and also small businesses in rural communities.
How granular does this get? And it's really a question for either of you. Are you guys going over things like don't use your dog's name as your password or like how in the weeds, like how beginner basic?
For us, we did do beginner basic because Dr. Dayton actually took us to a couple of the rural communities and we got to see how little people knew about cybersecurity. And so we did actually meet with a board at one of these communities and we were talking about the granulars of even like how to set up good passwords.
Scott, I imagine it's a little more involved when you're dealing with a community government who wants to know, okay, so our system has been breached. Our data is now like, you know, taken away and there's some person on the other end asking for money. Like, how do we handle this?
Yeah, that's the worst case scenario that we're, you know, trying to avoid. You're absolutely right. But unfortunately, a lot of communities haven't been able to, right? We've seen several states like Louisiana have to declare states of emergency following the number of cyber attacks that their communities, including their healthcare providers, have been facing. So in the clinic, as Sydney was just describing, we try to lean into a more proactive mindset. So try to get your house in order so that when the unfortunately probably inevitable happens, you're able to respond as quickly and completely as possible, right? That's easier said than done. There are some basics that organizations should be mindful about, like keeping up backups of your data on site, in the cloud, using multi-factor authentication. So giving that extra layer of security there, whether it's through, you know, some kind of text message or email verification. And if you're a small utility, we've seen a lot of problems with making sure that remote access, so making sure that employees who are logging into your system from the internet, that's done in a secure manner. We've seen water utilities across the country being targeted lately. And in large part, those have been successful because there's just so many outdated systems and so much insecure remote access and kind of ways in. So picture these all as layers of Swiss cheese. There's holes in all of them, but the more layers you can put on top of each other, the harder it is for the bad guys to find a way through.
I like that analogy. I don't like Swiss cheese, but I do like that analogy. Stillman College in Alabama is part of this consortium, and it formed after a cyber attack crippled the university for nearly a year, which is just wild to me. But Stillman is the first historically black college in the consortium, and it's involving more minority students and minority-owned businesses in his work. How has that, changed the program?
Yeah, that's been really foundational. They were highlighted, it's kind of Stillman's story, during this big Google.org announcement. And Google.org deserves a lot of credit here because they've done a lot to fund this consortium of universities across the country.
$20 million grant, nothing to sneeze at.
Nothing to sneeze at. Exactly right. With the goal of at least having one community college and university in each state offering these services to local communities. That's still, a drop in the bucket. But if you can leverage those trusted networks, that goes a long way. And like you said, particularly for populations that might feel more, sidelined for plenty of very legitimate historical reasons, but also still from the resources they need to protect their, physical assets and all their intellectual property, right? So if you have these, trusted institutions like Stillman that can provide that helping hand and be a go-between, that really is, that's a big deal for these organizations and also for the students to get that on-the-ground applied training that can really help set them apart in the workforce.
Sydney, is there anything about your time with the consortium that surprised you or changed the way you act with the internet?
Actually, yes, I was kind of before the class, and the professors had for the first semester I was in it, there was a weekly class that we would watch. And I was one of the victims of having one password for almost everything. And I made sure to go through and at least make it so my important stuff all had different passwords. And I think that's one of the most important things an individual can do.
Oh, but it's such a pain in the butt to have six passwords for six different things.
Yeah, it is.
I know.
And you could think about using, a password manager if you feel so inclined, so that you just remember one unique password. And then in turn, that can generate all of these anonymized passwords for you. All your eggs are in one basket, right? And we've seen some breaches at companies like LastPass. So there's a problem there, too. But, if the alternative, like you said, is just having one password for everything else, then, it's an opportunity cost.
So do you only take nonprofits and businesses and community governments from your geographic area, or do you take anybody from anywhere?
Yeah, we've helped organizations actually around the world. Our focus is definitely on, state and regional critical infrastructure providers. So these would be the local governments, community foundations, small utilities, kind of the soft underbelly that are just vital to the functioning of our society, but just don't often get the resources or the attention that the big, multinational tech companies or the big federal agencies are getting. So that's our focus. And most of our clients still come from that pool, whether it's, fire departments or small water utilities, that kind of thing. But we've done international capacity building work as well in Kosovo, in Ghana, most recently North Macedonia.
Oh, wow.
And there's an impetus right now, a bit of a push to basically spread this model much more globally, right? And one thing that we really would like to be doing more of is partnering with other classrooms and other universities around the world so the students can work together and help out different clients in different areas. So we're working on projects right now for our students to be doing exactly that with their colleagues in Europe and hopefully before too long in Costa Rica as well.
You know what's interesting, Sydney, is, I would think of computer programmers, IT people, maybe engineers, but having law students get involved in this was really fascinating to me. How do you guys fit into that sphere outside of, I don't know. Well, you tell me.
Yeah, so in the clinic, we were able to help with everything and learn about cybersecurity as a whole. But I think lawyers also have a big role in helping with coming up, in privacy. It's kind of it's not the law of the landless quite totally, but it's almost there. So trying to work through protecting people and protecting companies whenever they do have a breach, or helping give clients legal.
What's your legal liability?
Yeah, your liabilities. Yeah.
Because, you think nonprofit might have donor data. I mean, county governments, communities, they have all kinds of data on their taxpayers, on like homes and properties. Yeah, they like a local health department might have a lot of sensitive information.
And so we learned about that also in the cybersecurity clinic. And I think that that's actually nice because then there were also some students that were not law students in the clinic, and they kind of got to learn a little bit about those liabilities as well.
Yeah, I guess if you think about all the places and pieces that all different entities have about you, it's kind of scary, to be honest.
It really is. And as you're pointing out, there's not one federal, privacy bill of rights. So right now you're left with a lot of protections at the state level, depending on where you live. And only some federal carve-outs for things like personal health information or financial information. Right now, there's a bill pending in Congress, the American Privacy Rights Act, that would really change that and move us more in the direction of Europe with the General Data Protection Regulation, which would be more of like a privacy bill of rights. But I know it's shocking Congress hasn't acted yet. And I know we're holding our breath, but it's an election year and there's a few other things going on right now.
Yeah. So I will say that this consortium doesn't have a school here in the great state of Ohio as of yet, but if there is a goal to get one in every state, hopefully that will change. But if somebody listening is like, man, I would love to talk to somebody from your consortium, how do they reach you, Scott?
Absolutely. Well, they can feel free to email me directly. That's completely fine. They can also check out our site, which is cyberrisk.iu.edu, and that has information on the cybersecurity clinic. And there's also the cybersecurityclinics.org website, which has information on the consortium in Cleveland at the University of California at Berkeley, at their Center for Long-Term Cybersecurity. They really led the charge here for us in getting the consortium scaled, and they deserve a lot of credit for its success. We founded it with them and some folks from MIT in Alabama just a few years ago. And you can see how fast it's already grown. And like I said, I'm really excited to take it more globally as well, because there's just unfortunately a ton of need out there.
Does it cost anything? Like, do you guys, nope, no charge?
No, each clinic's a bit different, right? But by and large, they're all free. Ours is free. We're supported in large part by the different, grants that we've gotten from different organizations, most recently, Google.org. And also, frankly, just a lot of wonderful volunteers, including alumni. I won't be leaning on you too soon to serve as clinical fellows and help just mentor as well, which is an invaluable resource here.
Yeah, so Sydney, as you move on into your career post graduation, like what do you think you're going to take with you from this program into whatever kind of law you decide to practice?
Yeah, I definitely think the main thing that I'll take is just the client interactions and learning how to talk and explain the law to different clients.
Yeah, that's true, 'cause like it's about meeting them like where they are. That was Sydney Scher, who just graduated from law school at Indiana University in Bloomington. Thank you so much for your time today, Sydney.
Yep, thank you.
And thanks to Professor Scott Shackelford, Executive Director of the Applied Cybersecurity Research at Indiana University. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks again, Anna.
Coming up, can a smartwatch help with hot flashes? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Are you a hot sleeper? Do you wake up in the middle of the night sweating through your sheets? Well, there's a watch that claims it can help with that. Here to explain more is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
So, Ember Labs claims that its watch-like device can help with hot flashes. How does it work?
Yeah, so this is a small watch-shaped, but to be clear, not a watch, thing that sits on your wrist, and specifically the kind of watch-shaped circular bit actually goes on the inside of your wrist,
Oh.
and it rests on that kind of soft spot there. And using an app on your phone, you can give it instructions to either heat up or cool down. And by being in that soft spot there, it actually can kind of create the feeling of cooling off or heating up, depending on what environment you want to be in, by just having the one on your wrist. Now, according to Ember, we're not talking more than like a degree or two's difference. So if you are walking around in the hot summer, this will be a temporary relief that is being described here. This is not a, I'm wearing this thing so I can wear six layers and be perfectly cool in the middle of summer, but it is designed to be this, small relief in either direction if you need it.
And it sounds a lot more subtle than those big, like, fans people wear around their necks in the summer.
It is definitely a lot more subtle than that. This is something that, if you were to look, very closely at someone's wrist, it really wouldn't be immediately obvious what it was that they were wearing, other than some sort of bracelet. There's no, lights on it that light up to, imply that it's a gadget of any kind. It kind of looks like a odd piece of jewelry, and it exists in that form until you feel like you need it. So it's supposed to be something that you can wear all day, but only turn on, for an hour or two when you feel the need.
And it costs about $300, so it's about the price of a smartwatch. It's not any cheaper for sure.
Definitely. This is something that is, it's relatively early tech. There are so many different companies that are working on different versions of how to cool people down in different areas using technology. Sony has one that rests on the back of your neck and sits kind of like a set of headphones and does something sort of similar to this. But the big technical challenge that comes from a lot of this is that cooling people actually consumes way more power than heating people up. We've gotten electric hand warmers for quite some time now, and they're relatively inexpensive. You can usually get them for like $20 on Amazon, especially during the holidays. But cooling people down just requires a lot more power, a lot more tech, and usually somewhere for exhaust to go. So for this to be something that is designed to pull heat away from you and not require those things, and still be small enough that you'd actually be comfortable wearing it on a daily basis, even though it's a small change in, kind of personal temperature, it's a fairly significant step in the direction of personal cooling devices.
Oh, that's a good point. 'Cause yeah, I think about even those little like breakable things that you can put in like your gloves to keep your hands warm, those are so cheap and easy.
That's right. Yeah, heating people up is actually surprisingly easy compared to cooling people down.
Are there any risks associated with the watch?
It is still a gadget. It's still something that is battery powered that is sitting on your wrist. And, with that comes weight and, kind of general discomfort that can be associated with that sort of thing. So, this is not something that is going to be comfortable on every single wrist. You definitely want to try this out before, making that $300 investment. But as far as, actual risk to people, no, this is something that's been thoroughly tested.
I kind of wonder, does it monitor your temperature? Because, like, how does it know that it's time to cool you down?
So it doesn't know when it's time to cool you down. This is very much something that you as the user are inputting into the software. You get to go into the app and say, hey, turn the heat on or turn the cool on. And then it gives you kind of a battery monitor and lets you know, kind of what's going on there. This is not harvesting any personal data in any way there. It is really just relying on your input in order to be comfortable.
I wonder if maybe down the line it'll take your temperature and auto adjust. I imagine like that iteration is maybe a couple years off.
Yeah, we know that, temperature sensors that live on the wrist are definitely a thing that exists, but they tend to be kind of expensive and a little bulkier right now. So that is definitely something that would be possible in the future.
So let's talk about Apple. They're having a virtual event today, and there's been some speculation that they're going to showcase some new iPads. What are you expecting?
Yeah, so actually, because Apple is on the West Coast and they actually started the event a little early, we've actually got the announcement.
Okay.
They announced four sets of iPads. There are two different sizes of these iPads. Two of them are 11 inches and two of them are 13 inches. And they are labeled very much like previous generations, iPad Air and iPad Pro. From a mechanical perspective, the iPad Air is very similar in hardware to the iPad Pro that was released last year, which is to say that it's got a pretty nice processor. The big thing that is different about this year's models is that they are noticeably thinner than previous iPads. If you ever felt like your iPad Pro is a little on the bulky side, then this is designed to adjust that. And my personal biggest feature, something that I have wanted Apple to do for a very long time, is the camera on the iPad is no longer on the short end when you hold it like a piece of paper, and it is instead on the wide end when you hold it like you are holding it to watch a movie or talk to someone on Zoom or something like that. That is now where that camera lives.
Oh, that's neat. That is a definite change. I mean, people who manufacture iPad cases are going to have to hurry up and make some new ones.
That's exactly right. And that's actually one of the reasons that Apple made sure that as a part of this announcement, they also have a brand new case and keyboard to go with it, as well as a new Apple Pencil. This is called the Apple Pencil Pro. Unlike the previous versions of the Apple Pencil, where you've got the ability to kind of trace and pressure detection and things like that, there's also pressure squeezing on the pencil. So you can actually squeeze down and have something happen on the pencil, similar to how you would on AirPods.
Oh,
and
wow.
You can squeeze and twist. And actually, in several different art apps that they showed on stage, actually change brushes just by squeezing and twisting the pencil, which is very cool. Like, for seeing the demo on stage is very, very cool. And it led a lot of people to speculate that this is something that will become useful in the future in Apple's Vision Pro headset.
Yeah, because Apple is sort of known for its gestures, which, if people don't know, it's sort of like you can like use two fingers or one finger, swipe this way or that way on like the mouse pad on a laptop, or and all these different gestures do different things. And I love that they're adding them to the pencil.
That's exactly right. Yeah. The one downside to this pencil is that it's only compatible with the most recent version of iPad. So if you have the older iPad and you are like, oh, I'm just going to pick up this pencil, it will not work. That is super unfortunate. It's also not immediately clear why, other than because Apple really wants you to buy the new iPads.
That's unfortunate.
It is unfortunate, especially when the maxed out version of the 13-inch iPad Pro will run as high as $1,300.
That's like a laptop.
That is exactly like a laptop. Yeah, that's right. And that is not before you get into any of the accessories. So by the time you add a keyboard and a case, it will actually be more expensive than your average laptop.
So essentially, what I find really fascinating about this pencil is what you said earlier about how it could eventually relate to the Vision Pro, because essentially you could be gesturing and then activating stuff in space.
Yeah. So the one thing that the Apple Pro has that a ton of other things don't right now is just an enormous number of cameras. It uses multiple processors to see what's going on in the world around you. So it would be relatively trivial using a Bluetooth connection to know where that pencil is, you know, kind of in relation to you. So the idea of having that pencil that you can draw in space, and, you know, one of the cool things about early days of virtual reality were the way that people were finding how to use the space around them as a canvas for digital art and be able to create all of these different things. This is a really interesting step in that direction for Apple products.
Let's talk about Spotify. So apparently Spotify has started charging its non-premium listeners for lyrics. How do you charge somebody who doesn't have a credit card on file? What's going on?
Yeah. So if you have a free version of Spotify, if you're currently using Spotify free and you're not signed up to a paid account or a subscription or anything like that, up until very recently, you had the ability to just look at lyrics for whatever song that was being played. There's a friendly little button, you push on it, it shows you. There are a bunch of people who have, with the latest Spotify update, shared screenshots and you know, kind of video tutorials. There is now a capped limit to how many of those lyrics will be shown to you. It's varied in a couple of places. So it could be 10, it could be 5, where every time you tap on that lyrics button for the song that you're listening to, it just takes one of those away. And at the end of the month, that counter will reset. But if it's only, you know, 5 sets of lyrics, once you get to the end of that 5, it will then prompt you to upgrade to Spotify Premium in order to get access to those lyrics. Which is something that has been free on Spotify since its inception. This is a very new thing and not something that Spotify has officially announced. They just sort of quietly rolled it out.
So it's kind of like how news outlets will give you like 3 or 4 free articles and then they're going to start asking you to pay for ones.
It's a very similar concept. Yeah. And you'll actually see the counter. You'll see, you know, how many you have left in a given month in order to use for free. But yeah, this is something that Spotify is clearly testing. It is likely that there will be like an official announcement at some point with, you know, how many you'll be able to use. It seems like Spotify is testing different versions in different markets to see how their audiences react. But once they settle on that number, it's likely something that won't be changing anytime soon.
Yeah, it seems like streaming services like Spotify are increasingly moving away from any kind of like free offering.
Yeah, I mean, this is you're seeing this, you know, not just across the music industry, but across the publishing industry and you know, really just a ton of other places. The ad-based model is just not enough. You know, the goal is to have an ad-based model that is also submitted by subscriptions. You're seeing this with streaming services, with Netflix and Disney and HBO and a few other places, you know, not just having a you know, kind of low tier for a single user, but also requiring it to be ad supported. There are a couple of different services that have started showing ads when you pause a show or a song or something like that. But all of these are being tied into this, you know, trying to, you know, just kind of squeeze as much as they can out of every single user who are using those options. And the thing about Spotify is that for a lot of users, there's not really another option to go to right now, like as far as being able to stream as many different things as possible.
Yeah, even YouTube is starting to offer like premium subscription-based services that eliminate the ads before videos.
Yeah, if you haven't used YouTube without a subscription recently, it is fascinatingly bad how many times it prompts you to sign up for the service and gives you ads in, you know, kind of the worst possible places. It is a uniquely terrible experience compared to what YouTube was even 5 years ago.
You know, I saw this other article that I'm hoping I can ask you about, because the headline on it was like so wildly bizarre that I just have to ask about supersized clownfish robots coming to waterways in the Middle East. And I'm like, okie dokie, what the heck is going on here?
So this is part of, there are a ton of different initiatives that are doing versions of things like this, where they're deploying these kind of simple machines in waterways to help do things like cleanup and analysis of water areas. It's tough to go a couple of days without remembering that there is a giant patch of garbage somewhere in the middle of the ocean that we just sort of don't talk about most days. And, you know, all of that stuff comes from somewhere. So a lot of these efforts that you're seeing in a ton of different countries, and this one is unique because it is shaped like a fish.
It looks like Nemo.
It does look like Nemo. And the goal here is to you know, have these simple machines that don't require a ton of human interaction outside of like repair and maintenance. And they can sort of float around and swim and capture garbage as they're doing stuff.
Yeah. And also because they're sort of monitoring water temperature in certain cases, right? Because ocean, like people who monitor the temperature of the ocean says that it's warmer than it's ever been. So they're kind of
right.
Collecting a lot of data.
Yeah, these things are packed with sensors, and they can be sent around and, you know, kind of monitored for, I think, if I remember correctly, the duration without, you know, needing to be checked on is something like 30 days. So they can be kind of left to float around for 30 days and measure just as much information as possible. And all of that stuff is transmitted back to a base where it can be analyzed over time. And things like temperature as well as salinity levels are things that are being measured. I forget the entire list of all of their sensors, but it is an impressive amount of data that's being captured. And it's expected that before the end of 2025, there could be as many as 15 of these deployed.
And if people are wondering about the scale, like how big is the big clownfish? I guess they're like 4 feet long and they weigh about 65 pounds. So way larger than any regular clownfish in the water.
Yeah, no. I, you know, at the one point I was like, that's kind of confusing, but I think the scale, I think the thought there is that it will stop other, you know, nautical animals from trying to attack it. although I've got to say, if a shark ends up attacking this giant clownfish, I really hope that there's video of it.
Yeah. My favorite part of the whole article, like that I read ahead of this, was that the person who designed it has a background in animatronics for horror movies.
I actually missed that detail, and that is amazing.
Yeah, and so he built the robot, and I guess he builds like all kinds of like special effects, like mechanical robots for horror movies, and now he's building giant clownfish for the ocean.
I mean, that makes a ton of sense. You know, the goal there is to make something that is as realistic and reliable as possible. And when you build things like that for sets where, you know, people are going to swing into them and, you know, kind of do that kind of damage, that level of experience I can see being super useful when deploying something that is supposed to be in the ocean for you know, kind of long periods of time.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm not, because like 65 pounds, I mean, that's a big fish, but it's, you know, it could be lunch.
But it's not a particularly big robot.
No,
yeah.
It could also be lunch for a shark. You're right. So we'll have to see if they get attacked.
I really hope that it's something that gets recorded. I think that would be really impressive.
That was Russell Holly, the managing editor for commerce at CNET. Thank you, as always, for all of your time today.
Thank you for having me.
The All Sides staff here includes senior producer Marcus Charleston, producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz. We have intern David Stein with video production by the Ohio Channel. Board operation today was by Cameron Howard. WOSU News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson, and Radio Operations Director Kevin Petrilla. Thank you all for making All Sides possible, and thank you all so much for listening. Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook and follow us along on Twitter at WOSU All Sides.